Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 10th, and we are in Parshas Bo on page 356. And we are up to really the climax of the 10 plagues. Pasuk Chaf Tes, verse 29. Vayihi bachatzi halayla, was at the midpoint of the night. Vahashem hikachol b'char be'eretz Mitzrayim, and Hashem struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. Mibachor paro hayoshev al kiso, from the firstborn of Paro who was sitting on his throne. Ad b'char hashevi, all the way down to the firstborn of the captive, Asher Beves Habor, that was in the jail, in the pit in the ground. B'chol b'chor behemah, and all the firstborn animals. Hashem struck them all. Right. Vayakam Paro Laila. Paro got up at night. Hu b'chol avadah b'chol Mitzrayim, he and all of his servants in all of Egypt. Vatihid se'akah gedolah b'mitzrayim, and there was a great cry in Egypt. Ki ain bais, for there was no house, asher ain shamais, that there was no dead, that there was no one dead there. There was dead in every household. Vayikra leMoshe ulaAaron laila, he called to Moshe and to Aaron at night. Vayomer, and he said, kumu tzu'u mitoch ami, get up and leave from within my nation. Gam atem gam b'nei Yisrael, also you, also the Jews, ulechu ivdu es Hashem kedabrachem, and go serve Hashem as you said, meaning as opposed to how I said it. And that means as follows. Gam sonchem, gam bekarchem kechu, also your sheep, also your cattle take, kasher dibartem, as you spoke, v'lechu and go, uverachtem gam osi, and bless me as well. V'techazach Mitzrayim al ha'am, and the Egyptians, the translation here is imposed itself strongly. Okay, they were strong against on the nation. Lemaher l'shalcham min ha'aretz, to hasten them, to send them out of the land. Ki amru, for they said, kulanu meisim, we're all dying. Vayisa ha'am es b'tzeikot harem yechmatz, and the nation carried their dough prior to it becoming leaven. Misharosam, from their leftovers. Tzururos b'simosam, wrapped in their garments. Al shechmam, on their shoulders. And the Jews did as Moshe had said. From Egypt, silver utensils, gold utensils, and clothing. And Hashem put the favor of the nation in the eyes of Egypt. And they granted their request. And they gave them what they wanted. And they emptied Egypt. Egypt here was left with nothing. The Jews walked away with anything of value. They took it out of Egypt. Let's go back and read this through a little more carefully. Going back to Chav Tessa 29. It was in the middle of the night. Bachatzi halayla. We said before that Hashem had told Moshe that I'm going to do this in the exact midpoint of the night. Moshe had said kachatzos, which means about the midpoint of the night, and Hashem does it exactly at midpoint of the night. And Hashem struck all the Egyptians in the land of Egypt. From the firstborn, Hashem struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Paro all the way down to the captive and all of the firstborn animals. So first of all, let us make note of something which we saw probably about 4, maybe 5 years ago. sure, you remember like it was yesterday. If we go back to Parshas Lech Lecha and the war between the four kings and the five kings, and the four kings are victorious against the five kings, and then they take Lot captive, and Avraham chases after the four kings and makes war with them and defeats them. So on page 64, it says, page 64, Pasuk Tes Vav, verse 15, Vayechalek Alehem Laila, and he Well, let me read a little further. Vayechalek alhem laila hu va'avadav. He and his servants. Now the verb is vayechalek, and they divided, which the simple meaning is that he and his servants split up as they were chasing the remnants of the four kings. As Rashi explains, when an army is in retreat, they often lose their sense of organization and everybody just runs helter-skelter to get away from the enemy. And therefore, the pursuers, the ones who are winning the war, now need to split up to catch them. So they divided up at night. Vayakim, and they struck them. Vayadefem ad chova, and they chased them all the way to chova, asher mismol damasek, which was north of Damasek. Now, it says, vayechalek, and they divided up. So Rashi says, the Medrash tells us, vayechalek alehem laila. And Avraham split upon them the night. Which means, Avraham here was being granted a major miracle in defeating the four kings against all odds. Just him and his few servants, perhaps only one servant, depending on how we understand who he took with him. And Hashem is granting him a miracle in this night. So Avraham split the night. He used the first half of the night to defeat the four kings. And the second half of the night he didn't use at this time, and let it be held as
fund animation.
held back and used for the Jewish people when we would leave Egypt. So at the midpoint of the night, when that second half of the night of Avraham, which was a miraculous night, was still available to be used, that's when Hashem struck the Egyptians. This implies that Avraham, in a premeditated way, saved, so to speak, half the night. Now, obviously, Avraham can't really control that. It's a miracle that Hashem is providing. But, evidently, Avraham didn't want to use the entire schus, the entire merit of this night. In the Haggadah, at the end of the Haggadah, in Nirtzah, when we read about the various historical events that happened on the night of Pesach, and we've talked about some of them. One of them that is mentioned is this war with the four kings. That this happened on the 15th of Nisan, where Avraham is chasing the four kings and defeating them, and he understands that the 15th of Nisan is a miraculous night for the Jewish people, and he saves the second half of the night. So whether that were to take that literally or whether we're to take that figuratively, either way, we see that the Medrash, the Torah, is connecting this war between Avram and the four kings, which took place the first half of the night, with the Jews leaving Egypt and the decimation of Egypt in the second half of the night. Both taking place on the 15th of Nisan. That's an important point. It is also very important to remember that night warfare is something which is unheard of until very, very, very modern times. You can't fight what you can't see. And it doesn't matter whether you're the stronger army or the weaker army. At nighttime, you simply can't fight, because how are you supposed to find anybody? It's only very, very recently, especially with the advent of aviation. That's really what changed things, because you can still fly over and bomb the areas that have lights, and we know that before really modern times, so they tried to darken the cities so that the planes couldn't find them. But even that is just bombing. That's not real warfare. The real warfare of hand-to-hand combat that takes place in a real war, that can't be done at night, only during the day. Again, today there's so much technology, so some of it can be done at night. It's still not as effective, but it's a little bit more. But it's certainly only till very recent times there was no such thing as night warfare. It just never happened. So here, Rashi also makes this point, Vayechalek alehem laila, that Avraham chased them even in the nighttime. Even when normally one would stop fighting, Avraham continued to fight. It was so important to have daylight in a war that that later, when Yehoshua is defeating the major army of the non-Jews in Israel, in Canaan, where Yehoshua had defeated a few cities, and then many of the kings of Canaan were scared, and they banded together, and they fought with Yehoshua. So this was, therefore, the most critical battle in the conquering of Eretz Yisrael. But there were so many enemies that it was impossible to finish it in one day. And Yehoshua, though, had the upper hand and was winning the war. And Hashem, therefore, caused a miracle for him, and that's when the sun stood still. The reason why the sun had to stand still is because had it set, that battle would have ended, giving a chance for the enemies to regroup. And that was the reason for the miracle. So you see just how important it was in a battle to prevent the sun from setting, that Hashem created this major miracle of the sun standing still, which is one of the most famous and important miracles to have taken place in biblical times. Here, Abraham is willing to fight even at night, which means somehow he was able to continue the battle, even though the sun did not stand still. So that really begs the question, which, okay, Avraham, I understand that he was committed to defeating these four kings and saving Lot. That's fine. So I understand his heart was there, but how did he physically do it? How did he continue the war into the night? For Yehoshua, the sun had to stop. He couldn't continue into the night. Believe me, Yehoshua wanted to continue, but he couldn't. So Hashem stopped the sun. But Avraham, Hashem didn't stop the sun. He was able to continue into the night. How? Why? How does that work?
Full moon.
Well, full moon is not going to do it. It's not going to be enough. It'll be something. But you're right. It is a full moon. It is the middle of the month. It is the middle. It's the 15th of Nisan. It's true. But it's not necessarily going to be enough for a battle, for a real battle. Can't see what you're doing. I mean, even a full moon is not going to give you everything you need. Okay. So hold that thought for a minute. Back on page 356, let's read the words very carefully. Let's read exactly what it says in Pasuk Chavtes, verse 29. And you tell me what's wrong with this Pasuk. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla, it was in the middle of the night. V'Hashem hika chol b'chor be'eretz Mitzrayim. And God struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt. What's wrong with that statement?
We didn't strike the Jews.
Right. It doesn't say, and God struck every firstborn of the Egyptians. It says, God struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt. Weren't we in the land of Egypt?
Yeah.
We know that we were saved. The Jews were not killed. So why does the Torah write it this way? Doesn't that sound like it's inaccurate?
Hmm. Maybe we were never considered part of Egypt.
Well, when
we are there,
and Paro says to Moshe and Aaron in Lamanoff in 31, Kumu tsu'umi toch ami, get up and leave from within my nation. Sounds like we were quite ensconced there, which we were. Evidently, Bert is correct. Evidently, when it says every firstborn in the land of Egypt was struck, was killed, that is correct, that every firstborn in the land of Egypt was killed, that the Jewish firstborn were not in the land of Egypt. Then where were they?
Goshen. No?
That's also part of Egypt.
That's true. But hadn't we already put the blood?
Okay, so what does that mean that we put the blood? What does that do?
So that that was a protection.
Okay. It was a protection, but are we in Egypt? Okay.
All right.
So first of all, let's just, I didn't give enough credit to what Mrs. Starkman said before, that we did learn all the way back in Parashas Lech Lecha again, that one of the ways of understanding the gifts that Paro gave to Sarah after the episode where he took her and then returned her is that he gave her Goshen. It actually belonged to the Jewish people. Okay. That we can go down that. We mentioned that when we got to Goshen in Parshas Vayigash, when Yosef puts the Jews in Goshen, we talked about this a little bit. But let's not go there for the time being. Let's focus on this. Evidently, putting the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel, so then it says Hashem is going to jump over those houses. Evidently, somehow, that created a reality for those homes that we were in, that we were no longer in Egypt. The house was physically situated right there amongst the Egyptian homes. You had Egyptian home, Jewish home, Egyptian home. And Hashem literally passed over the house. The house is physically there, but somehow, on some level, it is no longer considered to be within the land of Egypt. Somehow, by listening to Hashem and putting the blood on the doorpost, it removes the presence of the Jews in the land of Egypt.
We already made a commitment with that.
That's true. That's true. But the commitment doesn't actually make us leave. They throw us out. That's when we actually leave. But somehow, there is on some level this idea that we're not there anymore. Yeah.
This we see in our own day with embassies.
Right. Very good. Excellent. That's a good
so
example.
You could say that we became sovereign people in our homes, and our homes were, although physically located there, not part of the country.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. It's a very nice example. So somehow there was some sort of asylum in those homes that they were like, right.
Houses of refuge.
Okay.
I don't know. We don't want to go there. Houses of refuge. Cities of refuge.
Refuge.
Yeah, I said refuge. Sorry. You heard it in your lap.
What's interesting, the simon with the blood, because we have the blood with the samsara, and we have the blood of Mila. And all it's so connected.
Yeah. Okay, we're not done though with the connections. So they're all the firstborn are killed. That's from Paro down to the captive, and including all the firstborn of animals.
But not Paro.
Not Paro. Okay, Paro doesn't die. Paro is a firstborn. He's the only one that doesn't die. That's right. That's true. Which we'll see about more later. Pasuk Lamed, verse 30. Paro gets up at night. There's an emphasis here. Paro gets up at night. It could have just said Vayakam Paro. Paro got up. But it stresses that he got up at night. Now this is because the Gemara says that kings were accustomed to waking up late in the day. The it is considered to be a leisurely thing for someone not to have to get up. We function based on an artificial clock that ignores when the sun rises and when the sun sets. But that is, again, a relatively modern phenomenon. Typically, a working class person, which was the vast majority of people in the world, a working class person got up at or earlier than the crack of dawn.
Right.
Because you got to work. And you can't work when it's dark. You can't see. It doesn't matter what kind of job you have, whether you are someone in the field, which certainly you can't work because it's too dark, or whether you are some sort of a craftsman, but it was expensive to use candles. And anyway, think of the kind of light that a candle would give. They didn't have the bright lights that we merit to have today. I say that with great emphasis because I am night blind. So for me, the lights that we have today are just I don't know how I would function in those days. But a working person needs light, so you got to be up. You can't waste your time. You can't get up late. You can't sleep in. If you sleep in, you lose money. You get fired.
Right.
You're not able to make a livelihood. You can't support your family. You gotta get up. Everybody got up. The only people who had the luxury of sleeping in were the very wealthy, were the kings. And therefore, they got up very late. And they tended to get up, as the Gemara says, in the third hour of the day. That's when they would get up, late in the day. This morning, my wife generally goes shopping on Sunday mornings. It's the easiest time to get away. And she goes, so we both get up very early on Sunday mornings, and she goes shopping, and I go to shul. And during the school year, there's a lot going on. My daughters do different things. They have different obligations that they have to do. But the school year is almost over, so today no one had any obligations. I came home at 8:45. I had davened at 7 and I had to do some work, and I came over at 9:15. My wife wasn't back from shopping yet. The house was quiet. Except for the little ones. But all the teenagers were fast asleep. Right? So, you know, that's a luxury. There's no such thing for a working person to be able to do that. You can't sleep in. So Paro, who is a king, he was accustomed to getting up late in the day. And the emphasis over here is, no, Paro got up in the middle of the night, which was very unusual for him. He got up in the middle of the night because he was awoken by the terrible screams that were going on throughout Egypt. Mm-hmm. He and all of his servants and all of Egypt, and there was a great cry, a great screaming in Egypt, for there was no house that did not have there someone who was dead. So here, Chazal explained that, our sages explained that someone died in every household. That when the firstborn were killed, it wasn't just, when we call a firstborn, we refer to a male firstborn, because we usually think about the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen, mm-hmm. of redeeming the firstborn. So that applies to a male firstborn, and he's the firstborn from his mother. If a man, if a woman has a child with one husband, and then she remarries and has a son with the second husband, for the second husband it's his first son, it's his first child, that child is not a bechor for this purpose, for redeeming the firstborn. Only it goes with the mother. On the other hand, we have the concept of getting double, that the firstborn son gets a double portion. Right. That goes from the father's side. Right. So we have those concepts of firstborn in halacha. But in Egypt, it was much broader than that. It was anyone who was a firstborn from either side, mother or father. And as Rashi explains, many of the women had committed adultery with bachelors that were around, and therefore a woman could have many children in the household that were all firstborns. One was the firstborn of her husband, and several were firstborns of other single men who she had sinned with. And so therefore, more than, they would think only this one's a firstborn, but then they would, then three would die or four would die.
And could the firstborn be a woman? Or a
so that's a discussion, whether it could be a female as well. I'll get that. Let me just finish this thought. That's a very good point. In addition, Rashi says that if there was no official firstborn in the house, then the oldest child would die. If there was no official firstborn. Let's say the firstborn had already moved out of the house, or the firstborn had already died many years earlier, then the oldest child would die. Hashem wanted there to be a death in every single household. Now, Dina's asking a good question. What about if the firstborn was a woman? Would the female die? And that is a discussion amongst the commentaries. Some say yes, which is why with the fast of the firstborn on Erev Pesach, where we know the minhag is that the custom is that the firstborn fast, and in order not to fast, they attend a siyum, which is the correct thing to do. But there's a discussion, what about a firstborn female, should she do it? We rule that she does not need to, but there are those who say that she should, because they say that the women also were killed over here, it wasn't just the men. But the common practice is that we don't impose that on women, only on the men.
But women did die?
It's a discussion.
Oh, that's what he's saying.
Some say yes, some say no. So according to those who say yes, they would say that a firstborn woman should also fast on the Erev Pesach, but the custom is not to do that. So there was in every household, there was a death. No one was spared, at least someone dying, and often it was more than one person dying in the household. So you can imagine, I mean, there is screaming, wailing, going on all over Egypt. Just imagine the noise, and people are dealing with a sudden death of a child across the board. Everybody, every single household.
But knowing this was going to happen, how could he even go to sleep?
Okay, good. What does it tell you about Paro?
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Very good.
How could anybody go to sleep knowing it was going to happen?
Plus, he's a bechor himself. How would you want to sleep if you think?
Well, he doesn't believe it until now, as we're about to see. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 31. Vayikra le Moshe u'le Aaron, Laila. He calls to Moshe and Aaron at night. Again, we're emphasizing this all happened at night. This was very unusual. Nighttime, it's so hard for us to picture what it means, nighttime, before the age of electricity. Nighttime was a time when nothing happened. Nothing happened. It was just quiet. There was nothing going on. Nighttime was nighttime. Today we're so used to, you know, cars driving at night, and there was no such thing. You couldn't go out in your carriage and your horse and buggy, and you couldn't see. It was dangerous. You couldn't go out on your horse, so you couldn't see where you were going. So, but this all happened at night. He called to Moshe and Aaron at night. There's the famous Medrash, which the kids always like at the Seder, and we, you know, a lot of families like to reenact it, where Paro went running to find Moshe and Aaron, but he didn't know exactly where they lived. He knew they were in Goshen, and he ran looking for Moshe and Aaron, and he would run, and the children would see Paro running, and he would be screaming, Heichan Moshe Sharoi, Heichan Aaron Sharoi, where is Moshe living, where is Aaron living? And they would point him down the block, and he'd go running down the block, but that wasn't where he was living. Then he'd get over there, they'd point him down there, and they'd make him run around in circles, trying to find Moshe and Aaron. They're deliberately driving Paro crazy. Yeah, that's
pajamas.
The famous song, right? Paro in pajamas. Right. Right, and he says, and he finally finds him, he says, Kumu tsu'umi tochami, get up and leave from within my nation. Also you, also all the Jews. Remember, Paro had said at one point, you go, but leave your children. Then he said, you go and your children, but leave behind your
cattle.
Sheep and cattle.
Okay.
Right. So he says, you go and go with all the Jews and serve Hashem as you said. Take with you the sheep and the cattle, just like you spoke, and leave. And also bless me. So why did he say also bless me? Because? Because Paro was also a firstborn.
Does that mean he wanted Moshe for that?
Right. Paro was also a firstborn, and here he now finally admits to the fact that he is in mortal danger. And he says, and give me a blessing as well, that I should not die, because I am a firstborn. And he does not die. Paro is the only Egyptian to be spared. The Egyptians are so upset and in pain that they actually force the Jews out as quickly as possible. Because they're saying, we're all dying. Kulano may seem, we're all dying. Rashi explains, because since more than one child died in the household sometimes, then they said, it's more than what Moshe said. Moshe said only the firstborn are dying. Here, three kids died, four kids died. So they were therefore very, very distraught, and they said, leave, leave, leave. Very important, Pasuk Lamed Aleph 34, the nation carried its dough before it became leavened. Their leftovers, I'm reading the English, bound up in their garments upon their shoulders. So this is matzah, although the Torah doesn't call it matzah over here. They took their dough prior to it becoming chametz. Now, let's analyze that. That implies that there was dough that was sitting there ready to rise. So they knew they were leaving the next morning. Hashem said they're leaving the next morning. They had put out dough to rise, but it turned out they had to leave faster than they had anticipated. So now they grab up the dough that was sitting there before it had a chance to rise. That's one form of matzah, although it's not baked either. Talk about that in a minute. Then a second thing it says here is, from the leftovers, they bound them up in their cloaks and put them on their shoulders. Now, what leftovers? Leftovers of
Korban Pesach.
And Korban Pesach couldn't be, because you weren't allowed to leave that over till morning. Korban Pesach had to be finished. The matzah and the maror. There was matzah that had been baked as matzah. I just want to emphasize this. There are two matzahs that were involved in the Pesach story. Somebody brought this up last time we met, and we're going to talk about this more extensively. I don't know if we'll flesh it out completely tonight, but the question of when we eat the matzah on Pesach night, what exactly are we commemorating? There were two matzahs involved. There is the matzah that Hashem commanded the Jewish people to eat with the Korban Pesach. That means, on the night of Pesach, on the 15th of Nisan, when the Jews sat down to their Seder with the Pesach sacrifice, they had already had dough that they baked without letting it rise. That's matzah. But there was another set of dough that they had put out, because every Jewish mother doesn't want to travel without having some food along for the trip. So they had put out dough, which they were going to bake and take with them the next morning. That they weren't going to make into matzah. That was going to be regular bread. But because they were thrown out so quickly, they were forced to scoop up that dough prior to it having a chance to rise. Now that's unbaked dough. And they carried it on their shoulders. The Medrash says that the sun baked the dough. As they're leaving Egypt with the with this dough on their shoulders, the sun bakes the dough.
And it takes 430 years?
We'll get to 430 years. We're not ready for that yet. Almost there. Almost there. I don't know. We may not get to it tonight. That's a good question. So the when the Jews sit down to eat at their first rest stop on the trip, there's two different matzahs that they have. They have the matzah that they were commanded to bake as matzah and eat with the Karban Pesach. And they also have matzah, which they were never intending for it to be matzah. It was intended to be bread, but because they were thrown out so quickly, they needed to bake it, or it baked by itself, and it was baked as matzah. So there's the intended matzah and the unintended matzah. Two different matzahs that they have with them. The Jews did as Moshe said, and they what's the word they use over here? They
requested,
okay, from the Egyptians, silver utensils, gold utensils, and clothing. And Hashem put the favor in their in the eyes of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians did as the Jews said, and the Jews emptied out Egypt. They literally emptied them out, which is going to be part of the incentive for the Egyptians to run after the Jews and end up getting drowned in the Red Sea, is because the Jews took everything of the Egyptians. The Egyptians ended up with absolutely nothing. Remember, they're already decimated because of the 10 plagues from food. All their food is finished. But now, even their valuables are gone. And therefore, they're going to chase the Jewish people.
The Egyptians, Hashem said that the Egyptians would from on their own give wealth to the Jews.
Yes, yes. Well, the Jews asked, and the Egyptians came. They didn't need to force the Egyptians.
Right. So why would they go after them now?
Oh, because they do. We're going to see later. Pharaoh is going to get them to change their minds.
Okay.
So, the theme, I've mentioned this to you before, and you see it here really clearly. The theme of Pesach night is that Pesach night has the characteristics of day. Pesach, which is the 15th of Nisan, the 15th of Nisan, every 24-hour period, has a sunrise to sunset, that's daytime, and a sunset to sunrise, which is nighttime. And we know that the two time frames have a different way that there's a different natural order during those times. The psukim, the verses say in many places that the nighttime is a dangerous time. It's not just because people can't see. It's the way that Hashem set up the natural order is that the night, it has things happen during the night which are more dangerous than during the day. Mazikin, demons roam at night, whatever that means. It's not relevant exactly what that means. The point is, the nighttime is a more dangerous time than during the day. And not only because we can't see so well. Pesach, the 15th of Nisan, is a 24-hour daytime. And as a result of that, the mitzvos that we do at the Seder are daytime mitzvos. Most mitzvos are only during the day. A mitzvah that can only be performed one time is almost always during the day. For example, Hallel. Hallel is a daytime mitzvah, except Pesach night. That's the only time Hallel is ever said at night. Because it's not nighttime. It's daytime. The whole concept of having a mitzvah of eating matzah, of making a bracha on eating matzah, making a bracha on eating maror, having a karban Pesach where the whole mitzvah is to eat it at night. You don't have that. You have usually a karban, a sacrifice, is eaten during the day, and you can also eat it into the night. But a Karban Pesach is not like that. You can't eat it during the day. You must eat it at night. When do you ever have a thing like that? It's the only carbon that you can only eat it at night. Because it's not nighttime. It's daytime. Almost always, mitzvahs are during the day, not at night. Very, very rarely do we have a mitzvah which is exclusively nighttime mitzvah. We have mitzvahs that are both day and night. For instance, eating in the sukkah. There's a daytime and nighttime. Listening to the Megillah. There's nighttime and daytime. Very rarely is there a mitzvah only at night. Now, menorah, lighting the menorah on Hanukkah, there's a nighttime mitzvah. But there, the whole point is nighttime, not because night is a day, but because the whole point of the menorah is to light up the night. It's to try to dispel that darkness. But the with Pesach, Pesach has a bechina. It has a metaphysical characteristic of being the daytime. This is emphasized here because what should have happened during the day happens at night. Paro gets up at night. He never gets up at night. He only gets up during the day. He calls to Moshe and Aaron at night. That never happens. Only during the day. The nighttime has been transformed into a daytime. That is why Hashem did not have the sun stand still for Avraham back with the four kings. Hashem has to make the sun stand still for Yehoshua because had it become nighttime, he couldn't wage war. So Hashem has to keep the day longer. But that's because the nighttime would have been nighttime. But the 15th of Nisan is not nighttime. It's daytime. And therefore, the night is treated as if it is a day. Does that mean that Abraham was given special infrared? Night vision goggles? I don't know what he was given. But somehow, the nighttime was not a deterrent. Because the Jews, on the 15th of Nisan, there is no night. It is only day. This is why we are going to get to it soon. Not tonight. We'll get to it fairly soon. The Pasuk is going to call the 15th of Nisan Leil Shimurim, a night of protection. It's a night of protection because it's not nighttime. It's daytime. It is considered from a perspective of how Hashem runs the world, it is considered to be a daytime.
Does it say in the Chumash that Abraham, that took place on the 15th?
It does not say it. No. Okay. No. That the Medrash tells us that it was the 15th. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we do say it in the Haggadah. At the end of the Haggadah, it does say it.
So how do they see then if it's really nighttime and you say it's really daytime? If there was no sun, there was no...
Yeah, I don't know how they saw. That I don't know the answer. I don't know whether Hashem made a miracle or whatever it is. But but it wasn't necessary to make a miracle to extend the day. It was only necessary to make them be able to function at night, because the night is a day on the 15th of Nisan. I mentioned this to you before, that it seems to me that the way we treat Tisha B'Av is the reverse. We treat Tisha B'Av as the day being like the night with Tisha B'Av, that we treat it that way. Some of the mitzvahs, for instance, men do not wear tefillin in the morning of Tisha B'Av, wait till the afternoon on Tisha B'Av, as we treat it almost like it's not daytime yet, that we're not ready yet for daytime. We treat it almost like it's nighttime. And Tisha B'Av is always the same day of the week as Pesach. Mm-hmm. And the mnemonic At Bashgar Dak, that the first day of Pesach is the same as Tisha B'Av. There's a link between the first day of Pesach and Tisha B'Av. Okay, that maybe we'll talk about it another time. So you have this concept of the day being the night being transformed into a daytime. The Jews then take with them the matzah. I'm just deciding. I think we can develop this in the next few minutes before we have to end. They take with them the matzah. The matzah, they were told to eat it with the Karban Pesach. But then they have to scoop it up and take it with them, and it was unintended. Now, first of all, just from a halachic perspective, what do you mean? How could they have prepared dough to rise into bread the next morning? Mm-hmm. It's still Pesach, right? It's, we can't do that. We wouldn't. We have 7 days, and right? We're not allowed to eat
Matzah. The first thing that came to my mind.
They kept Pesach on one day.
But they weren't given that commandment.
Okay, yeah. So first of all, Pesach, well, they weren't given it, they were told it.
Except me.
Okay, so Pesach, the first Pesach in Egypt, was only a one-day Pesach. Mm-hmm. It was only one-day Pesach. But that doesn't solve the problem completely. Because that means you have the 15th of Nisan. That's the night and then the day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they really shouldn't be able to eat chametz until the day is over, till the sun goes down.
Right.
Right. So there's two ways of understanding it. One way of understanding it is that in addition to the Jews that Pesach only being a one-day holiday, then they also did not have the prohibition of owning chametz. As we can't even own chametz. Forget you can't eat the chametz, you can't even own the chametz. They were allowed to own chametz. So they were preparing not to eat the next morning, they were preparing to eat the following night. But when are they going to cook? When are they going to bake? They're traveling. So they baked ahead of time, thinking they'll bake it in the morning before they leave, and then they'll wrap it up and save it for the meal the following night. But in the end, they had to leave so quickly they weren't able to bake it. That's one approach. There is another approach which has to do, it's a little bit more complicated, and the truth is we don't have the time now to develop it completely, but it has to do with the fact that we have the day following the night. As we know, Shabbos starts Friday night and ends on, let's say Shabbos, on Saturday night. First night and then day. There is a discussion of when that system came into play. That possibly before the Torah was given, the day preceded the night. So that the 15th of Nisan actually started with the daytime and went into the nighttime, and by the morning, it's no longer the 15th of Nisan.
Yeah.
It's the 16th of Nisan. So they were already allowed to eat bread the next day. So that would be another approach. We don't need to get all, you know, that's a little bit more complicated. But be that as it may, they had these two types of matzah. So we're going to have to talk about this further in next week's class, but let's just make it clear that if you think about the Seder, the matzah represents two things. Maror is bitter. That represents the bitterness. Right? The wine represents
the blood.
The wine. The four cups. Four cups represents
redemption.
Right? So maror is the slavery, and the four cups is the redemption. Matzah is both. Matzah, we say, halach ma'anya. This is the poor bread that our ancestors ate in Egypt,
because
that's what they were fed in Egypt. But at the same time, when we say matzah zu, this matzah al shuma, why do we eat it? Because they were thrown out of Egypt so quickly they didn't have a chance for their bread to rise. The matzah represents both. Matzah represents the slavery, because that's what they were forced to eat in Egypt. And it also represents the freedom, because when we left, we had to run out so quickly, we had to bake it before it had a chance to rise. They had with them two matzahs as well. One matzah was the matzah Hashem told them to eat with the Karban Pesach. That matzah, according to the simple understanding, is the matzah that represents slavery. Just like the maror represents slavery, they were commanded to eat the Karban Pesach with the food of slaves, with the matzah and the maror. That's the simple meaning. But they also had matzah with them that represented the freedom, because they were thrown out so quickly they had to bake it before it had a chance to rise.
So Hashem created a miracle that they had to leave right away.
That's right. And Hashem set it up this way that matzah would end up representing both.
Right.
What we still need to understand, so I'm showing you that they had both matzahs with them. What we need to understand is, why should matzah represent both? It's not, you see that it's not just by chance. Hashem obviously set them up this way, that it was going to end up being that matzah represents both sides of the coin. Why would it be that matzah is the thing that represents both? That can be that question can be understood and answered based on the type of food that it is, but also in the context of why should there be something that represents both? Doesn't that make any sense? Isn't it a lot more simple to say there are foods that slaves eat, maror, matzah, and there are foods that rich people or free people eat, meat, wine, Right? That's just splitting it that way seems to make a lot of sense. That there should be something that seems to cross the line is funny, because I would have said matzah is eaten by slaves and free people eat bread. That's what I would have said. But no, Hashem says, no. Matzah is going to represent both sides of the coin.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.